6:30 and 103.5 FM. The sweet licks from Kiss can mean only one thing. Our lawyer extraordinaire, Jeff O'Brien, is joined me in studio.
I kind of like that as my intro music.
I think it's going to have to be established, you know, something we'll have to... This is a good choice, too, by the way, Rob.
Detroit Rock City, good song. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the... I think it was... Was it called Detroit Rock City, the movie that came out about the kids who went to go see the band?
Oh, yeah, actually, I like that, too.
I enjoyed that movie.
It was better than Phantom of the Park. Is that what it was?
Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Now, you just say classic rock fan in general? Is that like...
I'm a music fan in general, but I've been a diehard Kiss fan since I was about 13 years old.
Wow.
I always say I have three favorite artists. It's Kiss, Prince, and the Rolling Stones. So, and if you would have thought that the last one touring of those three would have been the Rolling Stones, I wouldn't have believed you 20 years ago.
Nope. Would have lost that bet.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a little Kiss at the end of our conversation today, the potential of them continuing to tour via avatars. In the meantime, let's get to items that are more in your wheelhouse, lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien. Before we dive into what's going on with the Supreme Court, and there's quite a bit to tackle here, I wanted to get your thoughts. We reported this yesterday. Minnesota's medical cannabis director resigned, leaving the second opening for a marijuana regulator because we still don't have an individual to run the legalized marijuana aspect of what the state and the DFL has passed. That individual, of course, resigned one day after controversy erupted with her selling potentially products that did not meet state standard. And I know we've been talking about it more on that front. I'm just wondering, Jeff, with these two positions being left open still, do you think this is going to cause a delay? Has there been any sort of delay in the implementation moving forward as it relates to the legalization of marijuana without having a director right now? Or is it just a matter of now everything's just on hold until they get somebody?
Well, there's this acting director that had been acting director for OCM, and I believe that she's now going to be acting director for both programs, the medical and the adult use.
Should they combine them? It's at this point in time, almost seems like they should just consolidate it.
One would think. But there have been calls out there. They are working on proposed rules, and so there have been calls for public feedback and comment and things like that, input at this point, but there are no rules drafted at this point. I don't really know what's going on over there. I send email. There's an email address for the Office of Cannabis Management, and you can email them. And I did get somebody responding to me, but I don't know.
ChatGPT?
It could be. They could be using AI. It could be a bot. I don't know. I hope this doesn't delay the implementation of this. I mean, it's frustrating enough that, you know, folks have to wait 18 months to be able to, you know, get licensed to do this as a business. But, you know, and I was a little bit surprised by this because this was somebody that a number of us had sort of predicted might be named as the director of the Office of Cannabis Management because she is the most, it would seem to make sense, right? The most knowledgeable person in state government when it comes to cannabis issues might be the best person to run the office, but of course that's not how government works sometimes.
Well, I was just surprised that this was Chris Thokel's lead, who's led the Office of Medical Cannabis within the state since 2019. I was just surprised, and we talked about this a bunch yesterday, that she was leaving for a gig as the Minneapolis Director of Health Operations. It just seemed, based solely off of the news that I cover on a daily basis here on the show, it seemed like a weird move to go from a state level gig down to a Minneapolis level job. So, and again, that's just based off
of
what I cover.
I don't know the background as to the reasons why she's leaving. Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that she wasn't, I think I read that she voluntarily withdrew her name from consideration for the OCM position. So I don't know if there's some internal politics that we don't know about that led to her wanting to leave. She did lob a bomb out there before she left, because last week she's the one that said that the state doesn't have jurisdiction over the raw plants, that until something is extracted, the state doesn't have any jurisdiction. So that was, it sent the lawmakers scrambling, talking about closing this loophole next session. So we'll see where that goes. But there could be, I don't know, there could be some bad feelings there. I don't know. And maybe she feels that going to this position with Minneapolis is she's less on the radar for a lot of things, given how it seems to be the way that this program is rolling out is anything but smooth.
I invoked your name, lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien, a few times yesterday
because
we were talking about that story, but we were covering what was going on in Ohio, and we had talked about this before.
Yeah.
So Ohio, the GOP ended up, before it goes into law tomorrow, regulating the ability to grow at home, I believe. And then also they were looking at the increasing the tax revenue so they could spread it around a little bit more. Because they were in Ohio, if I remember correctly, the money coming from the sale of the recreational marijuana, the legalization of it, was going to something very similar than it was here. It was going back to communities that wanted to go and sell this. They were looking at equity issues, people that may have been hurt before because of it being illegal. And the GOP stepped in and wanted to go and make some changes. And apparently they're allowed to do that because this was a... initiative.
Yes, it wasn't like a constitutional amendment or something. It was the voters, you know, putting this out there, but they still had the Ohio Assembly or Legislature, whatever they call themselves, had the opportunity to either revise it or completely repeal it. So I guess the good part is they didn't completely repeal it. I'm not a fan of them removing the grow at home provisions. And I also think they included something that would allow, cities to prohibit, it might even be the sale as well. I think they also stripped kind of the social equity type.
Right.
Stuff out of it that like Minnesota has.
They wanted the funding to be directed back towards law enforcement and education of the harm of marijuana.
So, you know, at least, I guess the good thing is at least they didn't repeal it
right
completely. We'll see what else they do.
I don't see that happening here.
It just seems that, no, and it can't happen here. I mean, this is a state that doesn't allow, the only way that you get a constitutional amendment on the ballot here is if the legislature puts it on. There is no initiative and referendum where you can get a ballot, like California has, like some of these other states, where you can get ballot measures out in front of the voters without the legislature being involved. It just doesn't happen. So we'll see what happens. I'm not crazy about them, you know, putting further restrictions on it. I wish they would have kind of shown what a Republican type of cannabis program could be. But I guess time will tell.
The Supreme Court spent much of Tuesday morning beating up Andrew Grossman. This is according to an article from Vox. He's a lawyer asking the justices to revive a long defunct limit on Congress's ability to levy taxes. Now, the case Grossman was arguing, Moore versus the United States, is widely viewed as a preemptive strike on wealth taxes. That is, the taxes that target the stockpile wealth of very rich people that don't simply tax income rich people earn off of their wealth. So during the 2020 campaign, this is a bit of a get everybody up to speed on this. Elizabeth Warren proposed a 2% wealth tax on Americans worth over $50 million. Neither Warren's proposed tax nor anything similar has ever become law, and there's no chance that it will become law so long as Republicans control at least one House of Congress. The justices appeared extraordinarily skeptical, they write, of Grossman's arguments and of the idea the court should revive a long discredited limit on the federal government's taxing power. So just to get to just a few more details, and then we'll get into this. The article goes and says this is a very complex issue. The shortest explanation they give of what's at issue in Moore is that it asks whether the Constitution prohibits Congress from taxing investment income before that income is realized, meaning that the investor has sold an asset for profit or otherwise disposed of that asset. So this Vox article seems to be pointing to the fact that they believe that the conservative court appears to be reluctant in blowing up the federal government's power to tax rich people. So I guess with that, as we typically do, Jeff O'Brien, I'll sort of hand it off to you. And, you know, what are the aspects of this that you find, you know, most compelling?
Well, I do think the Moores are their argument's going to lose. And here's my position. So, you know, is what my wheelhouse when I in my practice, I do a lot of business law, corporate law. And a lot of small businesses are the entities that they that these business owners own are pass through entities. Could be a subchapter S corporation or a limited liability company. And with those companies, there is a tax return file, but those types of entities don't pay a corporate tax to the federal government, like a subchapter C corporation. Your big public corporations pay corporate taxes at corporate rates. But these pass-throughs, and this was a big issue with the in 2017 with the tax reforms when President Trump was in office, and I think it was Ron Johnson. Is he become a surrogate senator, a friend of the show? I forget what his
adopted senator.
Adopted senator. Okay.
Also a friend of the show, but adopted senator.
Ron Johnson was one of those that was working to make sure that the pass-through entities didn't get kind of caught up in a lot of the you know, from any unintended consequences from those tax reforms. But a pass-through entity, the owners of the entity pay taxes at their personal rate on a prorated basis, whatever their percentage ownership is in the entity for the tax liability. That's what this sounds like, because it's not a matter of they aren't getting the argument is, well, we're not getting dividends, so we shouldn't have to pay taxes. But if the court went the way that the Moores want, it could really mess up the federal government's tax structure for these pass-through entities, where this is the argument on the other side would be, it creates a disincentive to invest in American small businesses if somebody can go over and stash their money in a foreign entity and not have to pay tax on it. Whereas if they invested in, say, you know, a small business here, they'd have what the entity would be taxed on goes through the owner. Now, a lot of these businesses also have a provision where they distribute enough money to, they call them tax distributions. We distribute enough money to the owners, shareholders, members, whatever the case may be, in order to pay those tax liabilities, so they aren't out of pocket paying those. So this isn't, this idea of paying taxes when there's no money, when there's no income, It's not a strange concept. We do this all the time with pass-throughs.
The plaintiffs in Moore, getting back to what you were saying, are U.S. investors in a company that provides supplies to farmers in India. So, again, this was enacted, and again, as you mentioned, as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act going back to 2017, mm-hmm. in order to partially offset the cost of large tax breaks that law gave to corporations. In 2017, they paid more, an additional $14,729 in taxes due to the one-time provision. They then sued to get this money back, claiming the Constitution forbids the federal government from taxing unrealized income. I keep getting stuck on that unrealized income aspect of what they're describing here.
Yeah, I think when they say unrealized income, you know, the corporate entity, the foreign entity, has income, has made money, and they're being taxed on a percentage of that income,
right?
Which is no different than a pass-through entity, a domestic entity. Unrealized meaning they haven't received anything, right? They didn't get a dividend paid out or distribution, right? So they're saying we should only be taxed to the extent that we receive distributions, of profits. But we shouldn't be taxed otherwise. But like I said, a lot of our business entity tax structure in this country. Owners of businesses are taxed all the time, whether they get a distribution or not.
Gotcha. When it comes to the, and again, you may or may not know the answer to this question, Jeff O'Brien, but when it comes to the potential reluctance for the Supreme Court to go and act upon this because of the, for lack of a better way to phrase it, unintended consequences, mm-hmm. right? They keep saying this could upend, you know, the tax code. Do you have an opinion either way on what kind of influence that could carry in their decision? And I guess Roe v. Wade keeps popping into my head. That certainly had broad sweeping implications, yeah. as we know. Probably more so than a lot of us expected, but I'm just wondering your thoughts.
I don't see this ruling, if they go against the Moores, I don't see this opening the door as precedent for this tax on billionaires or some luxury tax. or wealth tax. This is different. This is a tax on, I mean, we do tax wealth when we have inheritance taxes and estate taxes. But this is, this, if they were to adopt the argument the Moore's attorney is making, this would upend business tax policy in this country, and they're just not going to,
gotcha.
They're not going to do that. So that would be the unintended consequence if they went, if they found for the Moores, is somebody would come in and say, well, I don't have to pay tax on this. I have 5% of this LLC. I don't have to pay. Why should I be paying taxes on it? So that's my view on it.
Before we move on to the next Supreme Court item with our lawyer extraordinaire, Jeff O'Brien, I just want to point out for clarification for producer Robbie that Andrew Grossman, the lawyer that's appearing before the justices, this was Moore versus the United States, not Moops.
Okay.
I know you were a little bit confused on that. So this is Moore's.
Did you hear that?
No,
I got to go tell the boy in the bubble.
Not.
I have to go let him know.
Not Moops.
Jeff, you do you like Trivial Pursuit?
Uh-huh.
All right, let's go here.
Just wondering.
This story, I find this... Now, I've watched a documentary... Or not documentary, let me back up. No. The series on Netflix. I believe it was Painkillers. I think that's what it was. This was the Matthew Broderick version of Purdue, Pharma, the Sacklers, the whole... What brought about the whole opioid crisis. So... This is in front of the Supreme Court right now. Nearly all of the U.S. Supreme Court justices, according to this version from the Daily Wire, seemed uncomfortable with undoing a controversial bankruptcy deal with the company behind OxyContin, the drug widely viewed as kickstarting the opioid epidemic. The High Court on Monday heard oral arguments in Harrington versus Purdue Pharma, specifically on the validity of the $6 billion bankruptcy deal with the pharmaceutical company that notably shields the Sackler family, who owns Purdue Pharma, from victims and their families' civil claims. So the bankruptcy agreement was quickly challenged, but eventually upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Currently, the Biden administration is asking the court to review the deal, arguing that the agreement is illegal largely because of the victims who did not consent to the agreement, which is about 3% in total of the victims involved here, and are now banned from suing the Sackler family as well. So, the Sackler family, Purdue Pharma, $6 billion bankruptcy deal, they paid this out, but it shields them from any sort of lawsuits coming from the victims of this. There's a very small portion, 3%. The majority of victims involved agreed to this. So the argument that they're making here is that if they go and undo this deal, there's a couple of different angles on this. I think one was that if, for example, one of the victims were to proceed, one of these 3% of the victims involved in this were to proceed with a lawsuit, they could drain the Sacklers of all the money and nobody gets anything.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the possibility, too, that these other victims could go and sue and they could completely lose, which would have the Sacklers off the hook even more than they already were. Am I right in this?
Yeah. So, I think it was the Hulu, the Dope Sick series.
There's
with
a third one out now
Michael
on Netflix,
Keaton.
Too.
I think it's a balancing act. I mean, I personally would love to see the Sacklers have to file, you know, lose everything and be criminally prosecuted after you watch what, you know,
because they're still insanely.
And I would go anybody at the FDA that approved the packaging that said this was safe and non-addictive.
Right.
Should have consequences too, but I digress. Legally speaking though, I understand where the court might be coming from in that if the settlement comes off the table because 3% are objecting to it. So that suggests that this was put out to the plaintiffs, the victims' families, and a majority of them supported this settlement as the best option possible. That if the risk would be if the settlement is undone because of this, then the Sacklers then are proceed forward. They rescind the settlement offer,
right?
And they just keep, you know, and they defend these lawsuits and win. Now they're not going to put anything more on the table. So they're basically throwing this money out there which I've read from the stories, apparently represents like the profits they made from selling OxyContin, that they offered that up in exchange for this immunity from further prosecution or from further civil liability personally.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it could be a tough case going after somebody personally when you're talking about them owning a business entity. Settlements, you know, having dealt with a lot of settlements of disputes over the years, no one's ever happy. It's a business judgment. And you have to take the emotion out of it and decide, is this the best option? And it sounds like for a lot of families, they felt that this is the best way to get some money from the Sacklers. And I think, you know, the Sacklers in some ways, by having their names stripped off of all the museum wings and endowments and everything else, you know, in their world, that's probably just as bad as filing bankruptcy and doing all that. But it's probably in this case, I don't see the grounds for why the Supreme Court would determine that the settlement is illegal. If this was agreed to by, like I said, 97% of the plaintiffs, it's, you know, this is similar to what happened with the concussion, NFL concussion lawsuit. There was an opt out where people could go directly, you know, the players could sue the NFL directly if they didn't like the settlement. And, you know, those lawsuits didn't go very far. So
it seems as if going back to the initial rationale as to why they had this deal in the first place was $6 billion. The Sacklers are worth $10 billion for all the reasons that we laid out. You know, they could challenge all of these in court with the victims and could end up keeping everything that they have because the victims certainly don't have the money. And it looks like even Justice Brett Kavanaugh was skeptical of this as well, even some of the conservative justices on the court. So I imagine that this deal will most likely stay in place.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff O'Brien, before we let you go this morning, got just about a minute left. We did talk about this earlier in the week. KISS has revealed digital avatars potentially to replace them after their final show. A lot of people are already pushing back on this, including many well-known KISS fans saying that, no, I have very little interest in seeing an avatar concert of KISS or anyone for that matter. It's like going to see a movie. It's no replacement for a live concert experience. Avatar KISS, what say you?
I won't be attending. You know, this is their attempt to do the ABBA thing and do that. Why, you know, someone pointed out somewhere on like a fan page, ABBA has a string of international hits and hasn't been performing since 1979. So much it works.
Yeah.
These guys have been touring for 50 years. The funny thing about it, you mentioned KISS meets the Phantom of the Park, which is their 1978 made for TV movie in which the plot line is they battle a demented genius inventor who creates a robot KISS to replace the real KISS. They literally have become the plot line for their TV movie. But hey, you know, if there's younger fans that like this stuff, more power to them.
I hear that Seal's going out on an Avatar-only tour, producer Robbie.
Is he?
Lawyer extraordinaire Jeff O'Brien, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Your intelligence and insight, always appreciative.